Content created with the help of generative artificial intelligence is popping up everywhere. And it's worrying people who make a living from creating their own content, such as artists. Now, as AI tools rapidly advance, some artists and content creators are trying to prevent these AI systems from using their intellectual property. Today, we speak with a computer scientist who explains how and why he thinks what's happening is indicative of a bigger ethical problem that's plagued computer science for decades. I'm Gemma Ware, and this is The Conversation Weekly, the world explained by experts. To help me introduce our story today, I'm speaking with Eric Smalley, science and technology editor at The Conversation in the US. Hey, Eric, welcome to the show.
Hi, Gemma. Thanks for having me on.
So, Eric, you've been covering artificial intelligence for The Conversation for a while now. And obviously, generative AI has grabbed a lot of public attention ever since these big public models were released a couple of years ago. I know you spend a lot of time thinking about the deeper research going on around AI that goes below the surface level novelty of it all. Tell us about the types of stories you're really interested in.
It's a fascinating area because there's so many angles to this topic. One thing I find really fascinating is the human tendency to anthropomorphize makes us really vulnerable to assuming much greater capabilities and knowledge on the part of these systems than they have. In reality, they're just very powerful statistical engines. They literally don't know what they're saying, even as they can sound quite eloquent when you're going back and forth with them. But since well before generative AI and large language models burst onto the scene, researchers have been working to give AIs a better sense of the world. For example, physics that we intuitively understand and common sense, things that babies learn like cause and effect. So that's an area of research I'm looking at. I'm also watching the sort of social and psychological aspects of how this technology is permeating society. There's so much fear and distrust around the technology, creative types feeling that their work is being stolen, creative and knowledge workers fearing losing their jobs, and people worrying about a flood of low-quality information products and services if AI does take over many jobs.
And content creators are trying to protect themselves and their work from these big AI models through something called data poisoning. Tell me about this.
Data poisoning is the practice of feeding these large models training data that can look to people like ordinary images, for example, but that are designed to throw off the model so that, for example, if you're training an image recognizer, you feed it thousands and thousands of images of cats, so it gets a sense of what a cat looks like. And data poisoning would involve feeding it images that a person would see as a cat, but that have subtle differences that the computer would interpret so that the output, when it generated what it was asked to a cat, it would not look like a good image of a cat to a human.
And I guess part of the reason for doing this is that there just really aren't that many rules and regulations out there about what data can be fed into these AI models and whether or not the companies behind them actually have the rights to use that data.
That's right. It's the question of copyright and ownership of the content that's being used to train the data and who can use it. The New York Times has filed a lawsuit against OpenAI, but that's just the most high-profile suit. Other content creators have sued AI companies, including a group of famous novelists, including John Grisham and George R.R. Martin, some nonfiction writers, and some smaller news outlets as well. The idea is that they are claiming that OpenAI and the other AI companies that use that data are infringing on their copyright. The AI company's defense is that it's fair use, that they're not republishing the content, but rather learning from it. It's not clear how these cases will turn out, but it could have big ramifications for the industry.
Great. Well, thank you for setting all that out, Eric. We'll be watching for more of your coverage of this on The Conversation.
Thanks. Great talking with you.
So we wanted to know more about how content creators are trying to protect their data before it gets to big courtroom battles. And someone who's been thinking a lot about this is Dan Angus. He's a professor of digital communication at Queensland University of Technology in Australia. When I called him up, he was game to do a little experiment with me. So I know you've got an AI image generator up on your computer screen that you're sharing with me right now. This is Midjourney, I believe, right?
Yep. Midjourney. So Midjourney is one of the popular generative AI systems, and it's an example of a generative AI that uses one of these very, very large foundation models at its base. So it is being built and trained on millions upon billions, perhaps, of images to build this. And this is a system where you can prompt it to generate an image.
Okay, so let's give it a prompt right now.
So let's do something fun like this. What about, say, a person riding a space ball in a Mars environment in the style of, what if I say like Van Gogh?
Yeah, Van Gogh. Van Gogh, right. As I say it here in the UK.
Van Gogh. So what it does now is it takes that prompt.
And it's thinking away.
And it's generating it pretty quickly, a series of four prototype images based on the prompt I've given it. And it's not done too bad, right?
No, right. I can see these four images, very stylized, aren't they? We've got the bull, we can see planets behind it. And there's one of these images at the bottom left. We've got a quite scary looking bull. It's trotting along kind of what looks like a Marsscape. There's someone riding this back of this bull in a spacesuit. We've put a link in our show notes to some of these images that Midjourney created from our prompts, so you can see them as you're listening.
These are examples of a generative AI, which is actually two algorithms that have been trained side by side. So one is a generator and the other one is a discriminator. And that's what we call an adversarial network. You have one system which is trying to classify known examples. And what we have is a data set of examples that we know match between, say, labels and the images. And on the other hand, you have a generator that's trying to generate synthetic examples. So it's trying to fake examples of the things. Mm. And it's trying to fool that discriminator into thinking that it is actually the authentic images. And these two systems are trained side by side in such a way that we end up with a generator which is really, really good at generating fake examples, and a discriminator which is really, really good at picking the real from the fakes. And these things are trained side by side until such a point that you end up with examples like what I'm showing you here, which is of a generator that can generate plausible and incredibly detailed examples that we as humans look at and think, well, that looks like a human design, that looks passable as a piece of art.
The more data that's fed into an AI model, the more the images it generates improve. Increasing the volume of data they're trained on is the key to creating increasingly detailed, high-resolution images. But many content creators who display or sell their work online object to its use as training material for these generative AI machines, in part because these machines can then turn around and become their competitors in the marketplace. And this is where data poisoning comes in. So if this image had been subject to data poisoning, what might we see that's different in this image?
So we might start to see subtle differences in the representation of objects. You might find the presence of additional objects within this according to a particular prompt. Or it could be that it mistakes a bull for something that looks like a horse, right? When you look at it with a human eye, you recognize an astronaut, you recognize a bull, you recognize Mars. The planet, the Mars being red and all of this. But with some data poisoning, the image itself underneath that at that kind of like pixel level and sub-pixel level has this kind of corruption within it that will completely skew the training of the model in particular directions. And so, you know, it doesn't take a lot of that to enter a system to start to cause havoc with how it generates if it's used in one of these generative AI systems. It might subtly reframe some of these things in particular ways that for a computer, it would have no understanding of why that should be different to what it's recreating in these instances.
So Dan, why would somebody want to do this?
Artists have a right to their intellectual property and their copyright. They have a style, usually. They have something which essentially is their accent, their signature, and that is what people recognize in their artwork and why, you know, they will receive commissions and receive some form of significance from that. And they work really hard at that. That's something that's, you know, generated over years, if not decades, for some artists to develop a signature style. And this is their trademark. That's what they do as artists. There's a statement usually in those choices or something they're doing, whatever is driving them in their creative process. The concern then is when these machines are able to duplicate those in a very, very thin way, that they're not doing it necessarily artistically, they're not doing it with the same intentionality perhaps, and ultimately their intellectual property might be being ripped off, right, and reproduced without their knowledge and certainly without any kind of financial compensation. So that is the concern, right, and why we need to be mindful about these new generative technologies and how they can intrude upon the intellectual property and the whole kind of financial ecosystem that supports art and artists.
One of the most popular ways of data poisoning for images at the moment is called Nightshade. It's a piece of software developed by a group of scholars at the University of Chicago in the US. It was released to the public in January 2024, and its creators say that it was downloaded over 250,000 times in its first week. Since then, the excitement has died down a bit, but it's still available to artists looking to protect their images. There are other approaches too that creators are using to stop generative AI models from scraping their work.
Another concern is around speech and people not needing a lot of audio data now to completely replicate someone's voice. And so you can apply similar technologies to insert qualities into the audio feed as well to manipulate that. So it becomes incredibly, you know, if not impossible to build one of these systems on because you don't have a clean piece of audio. So it might be imperceptible to the human ear, but for one of these systems, it would drive them crazy trying to train on this. And there are other ways in which you can inject this also into videos because videos are essentially just a sequence of images, really, with compression algorithms that run through that.
So like little bits of code or little bits of pixels or little bits of audio that are hidden that to our eyes or ears, no one would see. But then the algorithm would say, oh, well, this is meant to sound like, I don't know, Donald Trump. And then if you were trying to replicate it, it might sound like Vladimir Putin.
That's it. That's it.
What does this mean generally for how worried companies like OpenAI, which runs ChatGPT, or other companies who are selling generative AI tools, how worried should they be about data poisoning?
I don't think they're going to be worried by it, to be honest, because the uptake of this is not going to be significant necessarily. And it is the lower end of the market that are largely the ones that are going to be engaging in a lot of these practices around the dubious kind of just going out and scraping artists and trying to set up like a web store really quickly to rip them off. And so with the future models that they're creating, they're going to have workarounds that don't even necessarily even have to deal with these issues that we're talking about. The data poisoning for them where they would be worried is where you've got bad actors using it. Moral comparisons are really hard to make here, but my kind of positionality around this is more strength for the artists in trying to protect themselves from these tools, right? And if there are people out there, which there are, that are ripping artists off, then absolutely power to them for finding ways technically to try and protect their intellectual property and their moral rights. On the side, though, of where I see the bad actors using this might be to try to inject malicious code or other things into these systems. So an example of when I talk about malicious code is we now have these generative AI systems that are generating code snippets, right, that people are using. So they say, all right, give me a piece of code to do X, and it pops out an example. Where we could come into some really, really dangerous territory is if you've got people who might use this in, say, a really significant database of personal information, and they use a piece of code which creates a backdoor because someone's poisoned one of these code generation engines, and now they're just copying and pasting these in a way that's incredibly uncritical and ends up just generating really, really malicious backdoors inside their code example.
It's quite difficult to find out exactly what data a generative AI model was trained on. A few companies, notably Adobe and Getty, say that they trained their image generators only on images that they hold the copyright or license to use. But in general, the companies behind some of the biggest generative AI tools are quite cagey. In fact, in an interview in 2022 with Forbes, the founder of Midjourney, that's the image generator that Dan used to create the image of the space ball, admitted that its dataset had been built by scraping the internet. This practice of finding whatever's available online to train your new tool or algorithm is actually nothing new in the world of computer science.
In terms of how and why this data poisoning thing has come along, it's largely in response to a practice, which is in computer science, there tends not to be, and I'm going to throw an entire field under the bus here, so I apologize to the good computer scientists out there who do exist.
But you're speaking as a computer scientist.
As a computer scientist, right, that we don't tend to be taught in university principles of like legal rights and moral rights. And most computer science courses are pretty full to overflowing with largely maths and stats and these kinds of subjects. And there might be a bit of a bolt-on at the end of a bit of ethics and such, but rarely will you go deep into understanding conceptualizations of power and society and doing really serious interrogations of largely the humanities. That doesn't tend to exist in a lot of computer science courses. So what that means is it breeds a certain set of attitudes around data, which is that data found is data that is yours, that if you can find it online, if you can download it, it's fair game and you can use it for the training of an algorithm and that's just fine because the ends usually justify the means. The idea that look at these fantastic new algorithms we have and look at all the amazing things we can do with them and let's just kind of ignore the ickiness of the fact that we've ripped off thousands upon thousands, if not millions, of creative works from artists, authors, and others in order to arrive at this point because, you know, we now have this really, really fancy machine that's capable of all these amazing things. And so surely that kind of trumps any kind of, you know, moral obligation we might have had to have done a little bit more care about the curation of the data set and know that we do have permission to use these various works within our machine.
Dan told me a story that helps to illustrate his point. It began in an image compression lab at the University of Southern California in the US back in the early 1970s. Computer scientists there were trying to create image compression algorithms that we now use all the time when we make an image into a TIFF or a JPEG. These developers were trying to ensure that their algorithms would perform to the gold standard, that is, make the image smaller without losing any critical data that would affect the quality.
Now, they needed an example of a photograph. And what did they have in a computer science lab lying around many decades ago was a Playboy. And one of the members of the lab ripped an image of a centerfold out of it. The model's name was Lena, and scanned this image in and then put it in as a test image. And that Lena image has been used for decades by the image compression field as part of a standard test battery to test compression. And that scan was not authorized. I mean, Playboy allowed it to happen because it was good publicity for them. So they never really prosecuted them for essentially copyright infringement by taking one of their photos and using it in this way. Lena never really consented to her image being used in this. I mean, it gets weird when even at one point they invited her to a conference and had her there. And it took years for the field to really come about and go, hang on, this is really creepy and weird.
Yeah.
And maybe we shouldn't do this. And this underscores the cultural problem that I'm talking about, that someone in a lab felt empowered to just rip a page out of that magazine, to scan it, to use that data. And still many in that field see no problem with the use of that image to test algorithms. And it took the peak organization, the IEEE, to ban like any papers that now use it are not able to be published in some of the top journals in that field. So if you try to use it, they will not accept your publication. And that's what it's taken for the field to forget Lena. And that's just disappointing. And I think every computer scientist should really just have a bit of shame about that we have, a really deep cultural problem about how we treat data and how we generate these data sets and how we continue to talk about this and the kind of harms we permit in just not being mature about the way in which we approach the curation of our data sets.
Today, the foundational models of generative AI have already been trained on reams and reams of data from the internet, and there's no going back. People are already starting to complain about the sheer amount of AI-generated content now clogging up their social media feeds, and a simple Google search now sometimes turns up dozens of AI-written articles or images before getting to the real data. And this could turn out to be a much bigger problem for the AI companies than data poisoning.
So what we're in right now is this really crazy moment where these foundational models are all out there. They have been out there for a while. There is a concern now around those models being trained on generated data as well. And so now the cat is out of the bag and we've got a lot of this AI-generated content out there. We can't necessarily just go out and scrape willy-nilly from the internet for new content because there is a real concern when there's a real gross analogy to be made here, but it's like you don't want the system eating its own excrement, right? It needs a clean diet. It needs good, high-quality data in order to be trained and to build its capacities.
Is that going to be a problem going further down the line in the way that these models go and search for new ideas? I mean, people have talked about the in-shitification of the internet for a few years now, but there's kind of a worry out there, isn't there, that it's being speeded up by AI, that it's, you know, being generated. As you said, it's like eating its own excrement. I just wonder what that means for the kind of the future of where the data is coming from. If these people are trying to put up walls, the AI is trying to get into it, where does that lead us?
So for the longest time, like the original idea of the internet now is a very libertarian ideal. I think it was pretty naive as well in some ways. The idea that this thing was just going to exist on goodwill and free labor and everyone was just going to play ball was pretty naive, right? That ultimately the way that it's created now walled gardens and large corporations wresting control of it was absolutely predictable for anyone who was a sociologist or someone who understood neoliberalism and capitalism. It was always going to be something that was acquired by those vested interests. And that's to the detriment of humanity, right? That the internet has been bought and closed off by the likes of Meta and Alphabet and those other large, you know, FANG corporations. So that's where we find ourselves. And unfortunately, generative AI is the next in a long line of that, right? I'm not convinced that the creators of OpenAI and that are going to do it any differently, right? We're already seeing them give away the models for free initially, get us all hooked, and then it's like, oh, hey, you got to pay a subscription now and let's go. So unless we really attack the governance model and understand power, I don't see this AI moment going any differently to every other media technology that's come along to date.
Thank you so much, Dan, for explaining all this to us and telling us what we should and shouldn't be worried about in the future. Thank you.
No worries. Thanks so much for having me on.
That's it for this week's episode. We'll pop a link to the story on data poisoning that Dan and his colleague TJ Thompson wrote for The Conversation in the show notes for this episode. Thanks to our colleague Eric Smalley, who you heard at the top of the show, and also to Ben Zhao at the University of Chicago for providing us with information about nightshade. This episode was written and produced by Katie Flood, with production assistance from Mend Marawani. I'm Gemma Ware, the show's executive producer. Sound design was by Eloise Stevens, and our theme music is by Nita Saal. Stephen Kahn is our global executive editor, Alice Mason runs our social media, and Soraya Nandi does our transcripts. You can connect with us on Instagram at theconversation.com or email us directly at podcast@theconversation.com. Do sign up for The Conversation's free daily newsletter by clicking on the link in our show notes. And if you like what we do, please support our podcast and The Conversation more broadly by going to donate.theconversation.com. And please rate and review the show wherever you listen. It helps us reach a wider audience. Before we go, we've got a trailer for a brand new podcast from The Conversation that some of the little people in your life might enjoy. And it's made by our very own Eloise Stevens.
We were driving back from some place called Aladala and we were looking for whales. They were big. They looked like water coming out of a fountain. Then my brother farted. And then I wondered if whales fart or sneeze.
Hey kids, yes, you out there. Are you ever going about your life, cycling to school, doing your homework, and then ping, a question just pings into your head?
How high could you jump on the moon?
Why is my dog so cute?
If the asteroid hits Earth and then all the humans die, will the dinosaurs come back?
But who do you ask? Your mum doesn't know, your grandpa's not sure, and your baby brother just gurgles anytime you try to ask him. But what if you could ask an expert directly? Wait, you can! Welcome to the Conversations Curious Kids. I'm Eloise, and I, along with a big team of experts, are here to help you find out the answers to all your biggest questions. To do that, we're diving into the ocean. Shooting off into space at the speed of light.
So you're traveling. And the next day, you will arrive at another planet. There are some aliens living there, so you shake hands or whatever they have.
Hello.
We'll be hearing how scientists do their experiments.
As the whale takes a breath, the drone is flown through the snot with the petri dish open and deliberately collect as much snot as possible.
That was unbelievable. It was the big
and even doing some experiments of our own.
I have a tomato, a pea and a tea towel.
Hey, no spoilers. This is only the trailer. If you want to find out the answers, please tune in to the Conversations Curious Kids in partnership with Fun Kids. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. See you there.